Good morning, but I think everybody knows who I am. I'm Cliff Hall. Couple comments about this morning and the next session tomorrow morning. We kind of gave short shrift to aging, and so I'm going to take a little bit of time to go over a few things about aging today before we go into a kind of an introduction to medical ethics. And tomorrow we will spend most of the time talking about end-of-life issues. And relative to ethics and end-of-life, I'm just going to hand these things around. Some of you got these already. It's just a list of names and terms and stuff, and by the end of the by the end of the sessions, we should have touched on virtually all those names and things, and you should feel comfortable about the person's places and things. The other thing I decided that we've been way too serious up here, there's a lot of serious stuff going on. So I'm hopeful that today at least we can really lighten up our conversation and maybe inject a little bit of humor into it, as well as just some pleasant thoughts. So the book I'd recommend is this one here: is How We Die. And that's certainly something to get a good laugh on. It's by Sherwin Nuland. It's a great book. He describes all the different ways that we may or may not die and aging, and it's from a very wise person. Lots of interesting quotes in there from Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, who shared a close friendship, although there obviously was antagonism politically. They became very close. They both died on the 4th of July. The same year, which is kind of interesting. But they shared their views on aging, and he quotes some of it there. And the other book I would recommend, and I have, again, I have the list of the book list over there, is a book called Aging with Grace, which is the nun study, where nuns had unbelievable lifelong records, had all similar diets, medical care.
Also, they did Alzheimer's research?
Yes, it was Alzheimer's. It was a lot about aging in general, but there was a lot about Alzheimer's here, because they actually were able to get post-mortem examinations of the brains of these nuns and correlate that with medical records and personal records and writings going back to the time that they were teenagers and entered the convent, all the way to the time that they may have died at 80 or 90 years old. Just a fascinating and a tremendous amount of work. On the session where we just touched on aging, I asked a number of philosophical questions, and this will kind of lead us a little bit into ethics. I'm gonna ask you to ponder some of these questions again, just as a background as we talk about aging. And I'd be interested, as we go along, as we get to maybe toward the end of our discussion, about some feedback on that. Is there a maximum age limit for humans? And should we attempt to extend that maximum age limit? Is that a worthwhile goal? Or should our goal be improve the quality of life up until what seems to be our biological maximum, as opposed to pushing the envelope to 110, 115, 120? Is ageless youth better than the seasons of life? And this, I think, is going to be an ethical question that if not us, a generation or two from here is going to have to answer and deal with. Because what are the implications for population control? What are the implications just for what human existence means if we can actually stop or significantly slow down aging? What if we could all live to be 300 or 400 years? And that's not out of the question. It's scary. It's scary.
It's an old song now, but K-19, that's the Aretha Franklin.
It is old song. Should age be a factor in rationing health? Age is certainly a factor in telling how old people can be when they can drink alcohol or when they can drive a car. Should we put it at the other end, as in terms of getting certain types of treatment? Do we draw a line? I mean, can we all agree that anybody over 110 ought not get a heart transplant? And if we agree on that, then we've answered the question in the affirmative, haven't we? Yeah. And it's just a matter of what procedure at what age?
How does medicine? How do you guys talk about that?
Well, it depends whether you have insurance or not. It's simple, you know. What really happens in medicine, it's a good question. What really happens in medicine is that it's medical ethics that if the benefits exceed the risks, your physician has a moral or ethical obligation to offer that to you. Now, that doesn't say that it should be covered or is going to be covered or who's going to pay for it or whether you're going to accept it. Our job is to weigh the risks and benefits of anything for an individual, take the individual patient into consideration. Up until 25 years ago, essentially Bob could tell you this, what was our cutoff for a coronary bypass surgery 25 years ago?
About 70, 72.
So if somebody was 80 years old, had severe coronary chest pain, we knew it was coronary artery disease, and angioplasty didn't exist at the time, we did not send them to bypass surgery. Why? Not because we were rationing healthcare, but because they did so badly. 80-year-old person going to bypass surgery did badly. There was a high mortality, lots of morbidity, lots of strokes. Bob, what would you say now? Bob, by the way, works in a cardiac surgery. He's a physician's assistant, does all kinds of cardiac surgery day and night there in Wenatchee right now. What's the oldest patient you've operated on, either there or in Spokane, for bypass surgery?
The oldest patient I've operated on was 94. And that was a heart valve transplant, and he went back to Montana and continued ranching.
So
we told him he wouldn't make it. But now the line that we're usually drawing is if someone is in quote good health, they're able to take care of themselves. We're sort of looking at about 88, 89. If they have a lot of limitations, taken a lot of medications for different diseases and stuff, and are not able to care for themselves, we're actually heavily weighing the thing in favor of no surgery at that point. But it's still the patient's choice. But we hang a lot of black crepe, is what we say.
So do you always lay it out for them? Or are there some people you just choose not to lay it out for?
Like Cliff says, you have a moral obligation. Actually,
okay.
I feel a ethical thing to lay out both sides of the coin for.
Okay.
Surprisingly and we may touch on this, is that the patient will want one thing and the family will want another. Mm-hmm. And it's usually the family driving force, the kids, you know, whether it's a guilt trip or what, but it's a driving force to get the parent to say, okay. And that, what we do is we talk privately to the patient first, and then we present it to the family, with the family there.
Yeah.
So, ultimately, it depends on how malleable a parent will be, and if they can recognize what's really going on with the decision for surgery.
And it's not always clear that the risks are greater than the benefits, and that this is a balance. So I hope that answers your question.
Answer your question once more, the last one.
Should age be a factor in rationing health care?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I would ask the question slightly different.
Sure.
Should age be the criteria for rationing it?
The sole criterion?
Yeah.
Probably most of us are going to say no on that one, because
okay,
it's not only the age, it's the capability. There's a lot of other factors, as Bob was saying.
That's what I'm trying to get
at.
The question is...
I pose that other question. Under present conditions, can we agree that 100-year-old people or 110-year-old people we ought not put those kind of resources into a heart transplant, paid for by the by out of a common pool of funds.
Now you're adding a little bit more, but okay.
Well, but these were supposed to percolate. We weren't going to stop. Go ahead.
I had another question. If a person not only takes care of himself, but takes care of somebody else, probably a spouse or something, would that make, and was very mobile and everything, would that make you push the age up a little bit? Or
what? We don't really, we're concerned now with the person's ability to function in society as opposed to the age. And if they're actually carrying for another individual, for example, their spouse who is more ill than that person, what we do is we consult with the sociology people, the case manager stuff, and see what resources are available, whether it's church, whether it's society, various organizations, to help these people through the convalescence, their own convalescence, so they'll be able to care for the spouse. And we usually take that route and present that then to the patient. If the patient says, I've got to get back and take care of Mary because I've been married to her for 75 years and she can't do anything herself, we have to advise the person is you won't be able to do anything for yourself really for about 6 to 8 weeks. You won't be able to drive, you won't be able to lift her. She has to have help getting out of a chair, cooking, the usual thing. We try and present a realistic picture of what your life is going to be for the next 6 weeks under ideal conditions.
But you can see how this could lead into other ethical issues, such as anytime something's limited. Now, we like to think that money is unlimited, but we know that organs are limited. And so if we're going to have a liver transplant and we have a 30-year-old engineer who's very productive, works for Hewlett-Packard or something, versus a 60-year-old person who's homeless living off the street, they both need a liver transplant, do we treat those equally? Or should we? And so now we're going to get into ethics and how we discuss that, but that's just something how, you had a person that was providing a valuable service. Do we do something? Do we treat them differently? We try not to. We try not to, but sometimes it's hard not to include the social setting, some other factors in our decision making. But ideally, we'd like to treat individuals as of equal value. Yes.
There's currently on popular TV or on free TV, what are they? A sitcom drama about a fellow who is no longer at the hospital because he let the donor, the dollar donor, die because he had chosen to save the life of somebody else. So, his ethical dilemma got him out the door.
Okay, we're going to talk about aging, and let me just give you some. And so here's a doctor telling you about aging. Now should you listen to physicians? And I just want to go back to the Journal of the American Medical Association, May 2nd, 1896. So we get a little bit of a historical overview here. This is the official registration report in the state of Massachusetts. Contrary to popular opinion, I was not alive at the time. This is for the deaths that occurred between 1843 and 1866. The average age of physicians who died was 55.8 at that time. That was in the middle of last century. Lawyers lived longer. They lived 56.2. Judges lived the longest, 66 years. So they lived 10 years longer than the average doctor. And clergymen are not much better than physicians, 57. So you get to be a judge. Now, that may be, everything is confounding, because it may be that in order to be a judge, you have to be like 60 years old or something. So you would automatically, you have to be older to be a judge. So that may be why that was the case. Back in that same editorial, they talked about physicians who so abundantly dispense to others the means of health and life ought to claim a distinguished place in longevity. But unfortunately, this is not the case. And here's the sentence that you will like, Jim. It may be said of them in general, in serving others, they are consumed. In healing others, they are destroyed.
Is that really Read that again.
I knew you would like that. In serving others, they are consumed. In healing others, they are destroyed. Now, it's interesting they use the word consumed because consumption was probably the number one cause of death amongst physicians back in the middle of the 19th century.
Tuberculosis.
Tuberculosis, consumption being tuberculosis. And then they gave some advice to physicians. And so this is advice that obviously physicians back then were almost, well, they were exclusively men. They weren't women physicians in the 1800s. So for us men here, here's the advice that was given in the Journal of the American Medical Association for physicians to recognize that they're getting older, okay? It says, the lesson then that we should learn from our deceased colleagues is not to work too long. When you find your arterial tension increasing, your temporal artery becoming tortuous, your radial growing hard, especially if you have a little palpitation and pass an increased amount of limpid urine. Pretty descriptive. Whatever your years, know that old age is upon you. Henceforth, shape your life like one that is old. Curb your ambition. Be content with a small practice. Reduce your expenses. Give up your night work. Decline confinements. Take a long vacation in summer. Retire early. Drink not at all. Sell your horse. That means stop driving. Take a great deal of moderate exercise in open air. Watch the functions of the skin. Guard against the chill. Cultivate an even disposition. Study to be quiet.
That's nice.
Pretty good advice.
It's no different now.
No, it's really no different now. How is age defined? Webster's dictionary defines it, if I get this, forget what I just said. An unavoidable task of the living is to change with time. Change is psychologically painful, combined with the physical reality of stiff joints, facial wrinkles, frustrating forgetfulness. Aging is neither relished nor revered by our society. We empower ourselves with antioxidant vitamins, wrinkle reduction surgery, hair dye to prevent, reverse, disrupt, delay, or disguise the aging process. We prove our value by maintaining a ridiculously fast pace with an effervescent smile. We define our self-worth according to the many external modifiers that proclaim our youth. We are caught up in the fantasy that belies reality. Every day, our body and minds grow older. Webster's Collegiate Dictionary defines age as to become old, to show the effects or characteristics of increasing age. But it also has a second definition that says, age is to acquire a desirable quality by standing undisturbed for some time, to become mellow or mature. That's probably the better. We like that one better. This particular author concluded that aging well is giving to others. This is a group that really represents that. It is accepting our limitations with humor and dignity. It is cultivating the sparks of interest into our own eternal flame. There are lots of ways and lots of things that contribute to longevity and to good and successful aging. I'm trying to find a quote here that I don't have. I have two more things to hand around. These are different. They look alike on the surface. One is an article from 1999 on successful aging. The other one is from 2008 on like wine and cheese, we can improve with age. So it gives you a little bit. We talked a little bit about some of those factors. Genetics plays a big role. There's no question that having old parents is one of the best things you can do to live long. Select your parents well. Social and economic factors, we've talked at length about that, education, optimism versus pessimism. There is no question that optimistic people live longer than pessimistic people. Exercise is key. We demonstrated a lot of stuff yesterday about church attendance, and part of that is the social, part of it is behavior, other behaviors, part of it may be other things. There is evidence out there that having a pet, if you have a pet, you will live longer. There's also pretty good evidence that if you have a significant other in your life, you will live longer. If you're married, you will live longer, and you don't even need a good marriage. It doesn't matter whether it's a good marriage or a bad marriage. Well, of course, they always say, you know, a bad marriage makes you think you're different, and life seems longer. Yes.
I read a study that men live longer if they're married, but women, if they're single, live longer.
Women always live longer than men under any circumstance. Marriage has a much bigger impact on men than it does on women on longevity. I'm not sure if that you may be right on that, may not have much of an impact on longevity.
Marriage for women increases their life expectancy. A bad marriage decreases it.
For women, but not for men. Any marriage increases it for men.
Well, if you had a slave,
Cliff, what's the other piece? We just got the one.
Did you get the one, the wine and cheese?
I guess we'll
okay, well, we'll have to. These are some extra copies of the other. The other one was successful aging.
Okay,
we may not have had enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that true also for same-sex couples?
Is there somebody that didn't
get yes, I think that's it's having a partner or a really close friend or some. You know, it's that social involvement, and the closer that relationship is, the greater impact it has on you. But maybe not on women. If it is, it doesn't have much impact on women. But generally, people do live longer who are married. Provided one or the other spouse doesn't get murdered in the process. External things. Diet makes a difference. Naps make a difference. There was a big Greek study that showed that people who took a 30-minute nap every day after lunch. It's a Mediterranean custom anyway. So if you took a 30-minute nap, it decreased the risk of a heart attack by 30%. If you took a 60-minute nap, it decreased it by 50%. If you took an hour and a half, it was no better than if you didn't sleep at all. So your naps have to be relatively short, I don't know what to make of data like that, but they're kind of interesting. Big reduction. It's probably better to have a pet than a husband.
What I repeat myself.
I think that depends on the pet.
Depends on the husband.
I'm thinking like a pet snake or something. You know. The more sex you have, the better. Exercise important. Communing with nature is very important. The old Ben Franklin, early to bed, early to rise, having a cycle, having your own cycle in tune with the day-night variation. We evolved that way. We absolutely evolved. We did not evolve with lights on, being up late at night, 11 o'clock at night, watching television, and then sleeping till 9 o'clock with all the shades pulled down. Our evolution is tied into a day-night cycle. Menstrual cycles are tied into a 30-day moon cycle. We are products of this environment in a very major way, and we deny that in modern science with electrolytes and things of that sort have allowed us to violate those basic biologic things that we have not discarded yet in an evolutionary sense. It's very interesting that if you take fruit flies, they live exactly 21 days. I've done research with fruit flies, so I know that. They live 21 days and they all drop dead. That's about the life expectancy. You know, we live 100 years, we drop dead. Fruit flies live 21 days, they drop dead. If you expose them to, you keep switching the day-night, because you can, if you have fruit flies in a jar with a banana peel, And they're happy, they think life is pretty great here in this jar, but every, instead of having day-night cycles, then all of a sudden after 4 or 5 days you switch it on them and give them 12 hours of darkness when they were having lightness, and you keep switching that back and forth, they start to die sooner. And if you switch it enough times and really screw them up, they may only have a 12 or a 13 or a 14-day lifespan. They all die. They're all dead just from changing the light. They still have the food. They're still in the same jar. Everything else is the same just from changing that day-night cycle. And so what that tells us is that work cycles that put people on swing shifts and these other shifts that are not in tune with the environment are not healthy things for people. Well, we don't know that. I mean, they're not healthy things for fruit flies. But there's no reason to think this would not be the a similar situation for humans, and certainly it's very disruptive of our biological clocks. And if we were put into an environment that would had totally no lights at all for us, and we develop a cycle ourselves in terms of sleep, wake, and it's very close to a 24 hours. It's actually a little bit shorter than a 24 hours. It allows us to catch up on and tune to the cycle of nature. So I just throw that out at you. Silence and meditation and prayer and however you get there, what Herbert Benson would describe the relaxation response, Eastern religions would call meditation, we might call chanting or just having silence or being tuning into our breathing, all those things lower blood pressure, improve the immune response, improve our health, and presumably our longevity. Couple other things that people always ask about. Caffeine. Okay, all those think caffeine is good, raise your right hand. All those think it's bad, raise your left hand. It's basically good. It's not harmful. It's not harmful if you don't have heart disease and you don't take too much of it. And it does. And if you don't take it so that it interferes with sleep. But if you're a chronic caffeine user, it usually does not interfere with sleep. That's why these people who drink, you know, six cups of coffee a day can have a cup of coffee with the dinner at night and sleep just as well as somebody. But if you don't use coffee at all, it really will keep you awake, or most people. Wine, alcohol, beer, what's the take on that? Is it good or bad?
Moderation.
Good in moderation. A lot of controversy. The Californian wine industry, the French wine industry, will tell you that wine is better than beer. And of course, the beer people tell you that beer is better than spirits. I actually went with a close friend to a conference in Venice to study this. It was an international conference on alcohol and health. And the conclusion, and that was in 1999, there's been no research since then that has disproved. The evidence is really overwhelming. It's really great that moderate alcohol, there's a J-shaped curve for mortality rates. Remember I showed you some of those other curves? Well, it's a J-shaped curve for mortality. If you don't drink at all, you have a higher mortality than if you drink moderately. And then if you become a really heavy drinker, your mortality starts to go up. Goes up because you're in motor vehicle accidents, you fall, you wipe out your liver, you do bad, you pickle your brain, you do bad things if you really become a heavy binge drinker. But if moderate alcohol is a lower risk than teetotalers. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One may be social, is that moderate drinkers tend to be social drinkers and not just not drinking by themselves. The other thing is that it clearly has an impact on HDL cholesterol, which is the good cholesterol. It raises that. And there may be substances in the that go along with the alcohol that are beneficial. The red wine industry insists that they have things that the white wine industry doesn't have, and that the wines have things that beer doesn't have. It seems that the alcohol is by far the most important thing. It's not that overrides all the other ingredients that may be in these other drinks.
Regarding moderate drinking, could it be said that moderate drinkers are also in a being controlled? Isn't that a form of of daily medication or daily drugging. So isn't there, aren't the moderate drinkers actually paying a price for their soul?
What do you think?
Yeah,
I, that's a good question.
But what do you consider moderate?
What I drink.
Huh?
The amount that I drink.
Oh.
Well,
one or two drinks a week? Is that moderate?
Well,
it's
I only know both sides.
moderate is generally defined as one drink per day for a woman and two for a man. And a drink being defined as an ounce of alcohol or like a 5-ounce glass of wine would be a drink, or 8 ounces of beer, or a shot of whiskey.
So the hard liquor does the same things that the beer and
not
just
what happens if you everything is much more complicated than what it seems on the surface. If you look at wine drinkers and look at them socioeconomically compared to beer drinkers compared to hard alcohol drinkers, they are very different social economic groups right from the beginning. And it becomes very hard to, you know, to get those populations and really be able to come up with good conclusions. But study after study has demonstrated that moderate drinking, at least within whatever socioeconomic group you are in, it doesn't seem to make that much difference what you
so
use.
It's the alcohol.
It's alcohol.
Well, I think the excessive drinkers destroy their liver often.
No, they do. That's why that mortality starts to go up. Yeah. And plus there are more motor vehicle accidents, plus they fall down more and hit their heads and do a lot of other things. And they more likely involve risky behaviors. Yes?
Could you say it again? The heavy drinking is correlated to the socioeconomic class?
No, not heavy drinking. Drinking of beer drinkers tend to be of lower socioeconomic class than do wine drinkers, and spirit drinkers tend to be even at a lower educational and economic class.
Okay.
Now, obviously, the exception proves every rule. So that for any one individual, it may be that Bill Gates' alcohol choice is vodka, and I don't know that, but I would predict that it's wine.
Right.
So beer and hard liquor.
I'm sorry.
Beer and hard liquor are the.
Are
lower,
and lower tend to be lower socioeconomic than. Music. People who enjoy music or participate in music tend to live longer. There's been some epidemiologic studies. And you will all be happy to know chocolate.
Yeah.
Good stuff, chocolate. And then better than licorice.
Body temperature. If you happen to be someone whose normal body temperature is 96.8 instead of 98.6, they tend to live longer.
Okay.
And then it's probably tied in with how much people eat, too. I've read an article by a doctor that they've been checking that out. And I think the doctor's theory was that if you ate less, you'd have a lower body temperature.
That's not true.
But
I have never heard that. I do know that people have different metabolic rates. They clearly have different metabolic rates, and that one would, if what you said is true, and I don't know that it is or isn't. If someone has a higher metabolic rate and is burning things up, one might predict that their basal body temperature is going to be a little bit higher than someone who has a low. But basically, 98.6 is, you know, that's the temperature that works pretty normal for most people.
Mine is 96.8 is my normal.
Well, that's pretty good for a reptile.
It's not very good.
Correct. 98.6 or below is normal until you get down to about 95, in which case you're becoming hypothermic. I would be surprised that you were really at 96.8 all the time. That would surprise me that you don't have a lot of variation. We all have variation in the course of the day.
Yeah.
So it depends when you take it and where.
It's what I've taken it.
We often think that when we're old, the picture of age is living in nursing homes or something like that. It's the great majority of old people over 65 are living independently, and and you may have the statistics there on one of those sheets. I have it right here on this one, the like wine and cheese, the third paragraph down, where it says that. Majority live independently. More than 90% of older Oregonians currently live at home, which is not bad. 7% live in assisted living, residential care, or adult foster care, and fewer than 3% are in nursing home facilities. Mm-hmm. So that's all comers over the age of 65.
But 65 isn't all that old anymore.
65 is not all that old.
And so when are most people in a nursing home? If they get to...
I don't have that statistic, but obviously if you go into a nursing home, you know that the majority of people there are over 75 years of age. So it's obvious. I don't know what the percentage of 85-year-olds that are living alone or the percentage of 90-year-olds that are living at home. There are obviously many,
right.
And it's going to be more just from the data we presented the other night about the number of people that are going to make it to 90 or 100. Here's an article, a study that was done in the Netherlands, looking at the people over 100 years of age, and the majority, most, live with dementia. So, and that doesn't mean it's severe dementia, but they have a clear, measurable loss of intellectual capacity. Anything else about aging? How you can live longer, or do you want to live longer, or whatever?
I live in a community where people are over 55. Everybody has their own house and such. Can you tell the difference between someone who has Alzheimer's and someone who just has dementia?
No. Dementia is the generic term. It's like dementia is like an automobile, and Alzheimer's is like Chevrolet. So Chevrolet is the automobile, Alzheimer's is dementia. There's a whole series of different kinds of dementia. So dementia is loss of mental capacity. It may be a variety of different losses. They're not all the same.
Okay.
And it's very common as we get older. I thought you were going to ask me, how can we tell the difference between what's normal aging and what's early dementia? And
that would be good.
That is a good question. And I was hoping you wouldn't ask me that. This is how you get in trouble in this world, you know. You ask the wrong, you put questions in somebody else's mind, and then you have to answer them. It's not easy. It's not easy. We all get more forgetful as we get older. There is no question about that. And there's normal forgetfulness, which is, where did I put the keys? Mm-hmm. What we kind of say, if you forgot where you put the keys, that's normal. Mm-hmm. If you don't know what the keys are used for, that's dementia. But there are lots of tests. There are things that your physician can do in the office. There are something called a mini mental examination, which is just a few simple things. They draw a clock, and then you have to draw the same clock, or they tell you to make the hands at show it as 2 o'clock, and people get it all backward and get things mixed up. And you, if you have a certain score on it, you're more likely to have abnormal level of function, and that you can kind of get a measurement of that. And there are sophisticated tests for that as well, much more sophisticated tests.
Are there medications to give for Alzheimer's to slow it?
You know, you saw the movie the other night about drug companies pushing things?
Well, they advertise it on the TV now or something.
The amount of benefit that comes from Alzheimer's drugs in a population of individuals with Alzheimer's disease is pretty small. Some individuals do get some significant improvement. many don't get any improvement at all. And the total amount of improvement is so little that it's often not worth the side effect. People have, there's a lot of nausea with it, there's dizziness with it, there's a lot of side effects that go with it, and they're very expensive.
Sometimes the anxiety stuff works.
You know, it's making a dot, you know, labeling somebody can be pretty frightful too. It's scary for families, and the progression of disease is so variable. Some people can progress very, very rapidly. Other people, it's just a very slow progression. It's one of the things discussed in detail in Newland's book. We were supposed to be happier about this now. A little more lighthearted here. Dawn came in. Dawn, say something funny.
On Tuesday, if I'd have known we were going to have tomato soup for lunch, I would have wore a red shirt.
that's a manifestation of aging, isn't it? And I could not understand last night as I looked at my place where I was sitting when I got up and left. Why in the world they would serve spaghetti on a night with a white table? I splashed all over there. It looked like chainsaw murderer taking place. All right.
Well, I can say what I think is kind of funny. Maybe it's just funny to me. But I have a mother in a nursing home. She's closer to 103 than 102. Mm. And she's just fun. And she says she's always kind of been one that can just, you know, a comment, and she just hits it. Okay, well, she falls sometime, which she hates, because when you fall in a nursing home, then they have to watch you real carefully, and, oh, she says they make such a big deal out of it. But anyway, so one night she was getting up, and she fell. And this time, she hit her head, and so she started to bleed. She was bleeding, and of course, they had to make a big deal of it, and she had to go to the emergency room and get her head sewn up. And she was telling me about it, and she said, oh, there was so much blood on the floor. She said, it looked just like a slaughterhouse.
I can pass on a warning to you, as experienced by my mom's 100th birthday this past March, that if you put 100 candles on the cake and light them, the cake melts.
Good thing to know. The fire alarm will go off.
And as far as ethics, my mom always says, just throw me over the cliff or put me out on the curb. She's ready.
Well, people frequently are ready when the time comes and they've lived a long time. That's absolutely true.
Cliff? Our mom is in assisted living, and now she's in a dementia unit. But there's one, there's a man and his partner in Portland that I've known about for a long time, and his work really helps me lots, and has. And it's Arnie and Amy Mendel, and they're out of the Pacific Institute. Arnie Mendel is a Jungian psychologist and a physicist, and he has specialized in coma treatment, coma care, and he says that, and I'm not trying to extend life here with this, but he says that many of his patients have done some of their most important inner work in their last moments of life, and I think Arnie Mendel is one of the angels. He's a very important person for me, and he has people in the Northwest who are his kind of they're his followers, and Stan Tomandel and Ann Jacobs are some of his doing the work that he and Amy do, and you can sign up and work on conference telephone calls with these guys at very minimal cost. If you're in a situation like this, You work with professional caregivers, hospice workers, and you find truly inspirational examples of very practical things that that these professional caregivers are doing that that are very good for people in my situation. So if you check out Stan Demandel, Arnie Mindell, that would be a resource. And he would love you too, but you guys would like each other.
Aging, this is a quote we said earlier today, aging well is giving to others, is accepting our humor, it's accepting our limitations with humor and dignity, is cultivating sparks of interest into our own eternal flame. As we get older, our worlds get smaller, but our time becomes greater to explore that smaller area. And so, you know, the kind of way I look at it, with the 20-year-old, the mountain peaks, they're just a minor challenge. Traveling around the world is a minor challenge. Exploring almost everything is. And by the time you get to be 85, 90, or 95, you know, if you can make it to the bathroom, it's a good day. and it really is. I mean, people give up traveling so much when they're 80, and they can't physically go up to Heart Lake anymore. They can't do certain things, but the day is still there, the time is still there, and so the inner exploration, I think it's exactly what Jim is referring to.
There's also, you mentioned seasons. If anybody is interested, there's an amazing book by Brennan and Drewy, Brewi, and Brennan, Brennan, about the gifts of insight and true maturity and actually becoming self of the later years that can only happen.
And it's titled?
I don't remember the title, but they've only written one book, I believe. Brennan and Drewy.
And?
Drewy, Brewi. And I believe it's Brennan, Brennan. But looking at these last decades as probably the most growth, if people are open, and the most maturing, the rate of change that can be phenomenal. Our choice, but it can be. And if we're not demented to where we can't participate, assuming those things, it can be a phenomenal.
And dementia may is an external kind of thing. We're not really sure what's going on internally in some of these people to what things are they recognizing or understanding or exploring themselves at a level that is not a conscious level. So one just has to keep in mind that we don't really know what's going on. Don?
I was
going
to ask a couple of nights ago why Jimmy Carter's book, The Virtue of Aging, was such a small book.
So that's funny.
Good, that's a good question. I think you'll have to ask Jimmy about that. I think he didn't have too many. He didn't have too much to say.
Probably has a big print in it.
We're going to shift gears a little bit here, but before that, I just want to make a comment about we talked about maturing and maturing, and the women might appreciate this is the difference between a U.S. Treasury bond and a man.
One matures.
All right, that's enough of that, I guess. We're trying to keep this light here if we can. So we're going to go into a little discussion about ethics and medical ethics and how we make or how we try to make decisions that are ethical. And I suspect that everybody here, if I were to ask them, and I'm not going to, are you an ethical person? We would all say yes, that we're basically ethical people. And then we have to say, you know, how do we know that? How do we get there? How do we, what is it that makes us sure that we are, in fact, doing that? And it's part of human endeavor to try to figure this out. I mean, there's sort of three branches of philosophy. The simplistic way I look at what philosophy is all about, there's three branches. One is science. What's the nature of the universe? I think Don is a fine example of somebody that's trying to figure out what makes the universe tick. Those of us that are in the medical profession or the biologic sciences, we're trying to make out, you know, what's life and how do all these things work together? How did it get to be that way? The physicists are going another step beyond. So that's science. There's aesthetics. The people, the artists amongst us here, the poets, the writers, the musicians, are looking at what's beauty and how do we define it and how do we know it. And it's hard to... It's not intuitively obvious as why almost every one of us could look at those mountains this morning and think it was beautiful. Or why was that? Or see a sunset, or even see a little baby, one of the baby deer that walks around, and we're drawn to it. We think that's beautiful. And why do we think that's beautiful? And that's a whole endeavor of philosophy and human endeavor. And the third branch is aesthetic. What's good? And how do we know it? How do we recognize it? And that's what ethics is all about. And medical ethics gets down to not so much what's good and bad in terms of good and evil, but really what happens when you have problems that don't have an obvious answer, that we don't all agree. And those are the ethical dilemmas, and that's where we try to apply some principles. In order to apply those principles, we have to agree on some principles that we think are common. And technology has just thrown just a bunch of ethical dilemmas that we didn't have to even conceive of years ago. Just in our lifetime, the advances in technology. And so one writer referred to us, this generation of scientists, as scientific giants and ethical midgets. Kind of interesting concept. But the technology has kind of outpaced our ability to really think of what the implications are. The technology is there and out there almost before we have a chance to kind of think about it. And whether it deals with abortion or cloning, using embryonic cells in research, what are the implications of this? And obviously people have very different opinions about that. Organ transplantation, we mentioned that real briefly. When there's a shortage, anytime there's a shortage of anything, who is going to get it? How do we distribute it? What's a just distribution of sources? Medical records, there didn't used to be much in the way of medical records. The doctors you just went into the doctor's office and it was just one little office somewhere, and there wasn't a lot of sharing of things. Now we have these electronic medical records that all kinds of people can get access to, and so the confidentiality becomes a huge issue. It's one of the things that has stopped the dissemination of the use of electronic information in this country has been the concern and the fear of what happens when somebody's records are compromised in some way. And then the whole issue of end of life, and we're going to spend most of the time tomorrow talking about end of life issues. And didn't used to be a problem, you know. In 1850, it wasn't much of a problem when end of life came. There were no ventilators. There were no endotracheal tubes. There was no CPR. There were no pacemakers. We had no antibiotics. We didn't have IVs. You know, I mean, we didn't have to worry about withdrawing life support from anybody or whether we would give life support to anybody. And now that's a decision that's made almost on a daily, certainly on a daily basis everywhere, in every hospital, but almost every day by all of us. So it's kind of a... And we issue, now we have two states in the United States have physician-assisted suicide. And there's a huge amount of controversy about that. So, what are these rules or values or principles of medical ethics? The ethics basically is a system of values that we can agree on and that we live our lives by. And it really is a reflection of identifying what's good versus what's not good. And recognizing it, learning about it, loving it, and ultimately living it. Aristotle talked, and so this is not anything new. Human beings have been thinking about this for a long time. And Aristotle said, every day we make lots of little moral decisions, tiny little moral decisions. And those moral decisions become moral habits. And then the habits become moral character. And the character is what we are or who we are. So we really are what we do. We can talk about ethical principles and things, but it's really how we live our lives. That was the way Aristotle looked at it. Over the years, Western society anyway, has come to recognize within the world of medical ethics and what drives medical ethics, and it goes back to a certain extent to Hippocrates and times there, and even before that, basic principles that come back again and again and again, and they come underlying all of it is a service. People in the medical professions are performing a service, and so there's a level of competence, that's an obligation. But then there are four basic principles. One principle is to do no harm. You've always said, primum non cari, first, do no harm. Primum non nocere. And that's everywhere in the world of medicine, do no harm. Number two is to do good. Now, philosophers have come up, and ethicists have come up with names for those two things. Do no harm is non-maleficence. And to do good is beneficence. But it's easier for me to say, do no harm, do good. The third thing is autonomy. And autonomy is respect for an individual, and the importance of the individual. And that implies in medicine, as you can imagine, confidentiality, respect for choice, so the individual can make their own decisions. And the fourth principle is justice, is the equitable distribution of resources and services, or at least that we attempt to have some equitable distribution. And those are the four basic principles that virtually every physician will agree that those are the principles, that every ethicist will, if you ask them, what are the principles of medical ethics, they will tell you that those are the four principles that we have to judge everything we do against. So when there's a conflict, there's not much in there about stealing or murdering or stuff like that. Those things are pretty clear, although sometimes it's not clear where they all came from. But there are conflicts in medical ethics are where there's competing goods, such as confidentiality. If you go to a physician and you have an infectious disease and you ask that and you want to get it treated and you ask that physician, don't tell anybody about that. Now we have an ethical dilemma, don't we? Especially if that's an infectious disease that could be spread to somebody else, especially to an intimate partner. Where's the obligation of the physician? The physician has an obligation. Autonomy is to respect the patient's desire for confidentiality. That's a strong, strong desire. But the physician also has a responsibility and obligation to do no harm. Which, if he doesn't let the partner know, then that partner may be exposed to something. And so there's an ethical dilemma. And right down the list, if we want to do embryonic stem cell research, do we have to destroy a potential human life in order to get the cells? Is that an ethical dilemma? To keep someone alive on a ventilator or withdraw it, depending on what different people choose, those sometimes can be very marked ethical dilemmas. The child that needs the blood transfusion and the parents feel very strongly for religious reasons not to give it. Each a potential good, but competing with each other. And that's basically what we will be talking about. Let me just say something about professionalism, because we have the medical profession under my generation's watch has watched professionalism decrease. We have overt manifestations of professionalism. One is the Hippocratic Oath. Everybody's heard of the Hippocratic Oath. Probably nobody knows what's in it. And if you knew it was in it, you'd say, boy, that's archaic and outdated and stupid. And I'll tell you why in a moment. We have codes of behavior. We have educational and accreditation of educational that the profession's been allowed to do, and regulation that the profession in the past has been allowed to do. When I got my license in Oregon, 1973, the Board of Medical Examiners consisted of a group of physicians. They were appointed by the governor. Board of Medical Examiners today has very heavy representation of the general public on that board. No longer are physicians self-regulated. And why? Because we didn't regulate ourselves very well. We had our self-interest as a profession before the interest of the public, and the public has had to step in. And then we doctors go around and say, oh, the public's, you know, everybody's riding us and telling us what to do and everything. Well, it's because we really didn't hold true to those tenets of professionalism. But let me just say one thing about Hippocratic Oath, and then we can go have lunch. The Hippocratic Oath, it starts off by saying, I swear by Apollo, the physician, and by Hygieia and Panacea and all the gods and goddesses, that I will keep this oath. It was solemn. I mean, that's a polytheistic religion, but when you say you swear by all the gods and goddesses, not only the gods of medicine, but the gods, that was a very solemn oath that Hippocrates and his followers took. And then what did they do? The first paragraph is all about teaching and about respect for the teachers. And what the Hippocratic Oath has, it has three do's and five don'ts. That's essentially what the Hippocratic Oath is. You swear to do it. Do you remember? Did you take it? I'm not even sure whether we took the old oath or a modified oath. Right now, most medical schools have a modified Hippocratic Oath. Yeah. And
I don't remember doing anything by Apollo, so I suspect there was a modification. So.
Yeah, I think, you know, they've all eliminated God out of all the oaths now, don't have God in it. But to the ancient Greeks, it was a sacred oath, and they had three things to do. One was to teach; had a responsibility to teach and respect the elders in the profession. The second was to do good, and the third was to keep confidentiality. Interesting. That's a long time ago, and they hit a couple of the major ethical principles were being espoused back then. And then there were five don'ts. Do no harm. Oh, they picked up another one along the way, didn't they? Not perform abortion. Not seduce your patient sexually. And the way it's phrased is you won't enter any house to seduce the patient, be they male or female, free or slave. That's what's in the Hippocratic Oath. Kind of interesting, isn't it? Will not give a deadly drug, even if asked. And we're already seeing that performing abortion, which has changed over the years, and giving a deadly drug certainly is permissible in at least two states and several European countries. And the last one is will not do surgery. Well, boy, that's why we went into internal medicine, right? Because that was in there. That was will not cut for the stone. And there was good reason not to do abortion, because people died because septic abortion was, nobody understood things back then. Almost everybody had an abortion died. Almost everybody had underwent surgery died. And it says, leave that to the practitioners of that art. I mean, a very condescending look at whoever the surgeons were back in those days that occasionally would cut on people that were in some horrible pain or some huge abscess or something, but the death rates were so high that Hippocrates said, we're not going to have any part of that. But obviously that has changed. So the Hippocratic Oath is grossly out of date, but at the same time contains the nuggets of what medical ethics and what medical professionalism is. So anyway, we've gone over a little bit. We'll pick up from the medical ethics and how that applies to end-of-life kinds of decision-making, and I hope we can draw. I think everyone here has had experience with loved ones, family members who have died and under maybe ideal death. Maybe they've had the really good death that we all kind of hope for, or maybe they haven't been, and maybe we can kind of learn from that common experience that we have. Thank you very much for listening.